world peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Ora Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. In a bad week for Germany's military, a phone leak revealed politically sensitive discussions about arming Ukraine, and a German warship almost shot down an American drone. Can Germany still be trusted by its allies? And Japan has a worryingly low birth rate. People are not having enough children to replenish the population. Our correspondent visits two exceptional towns that are making good efforts to change that. Could they spread the baby fever? But first, at the last British election in 2019, Labour chalked up its fourth defeat in a row. It was the party's worst result in almost a century. And the Tories were eyeing up another decade in power on the back of a landslide victory.
Tonight, I've had a text to say they just cannot believe it. This is the kind of majority they dreamt of at the start of this campaign.
But now, it's those same Conservatives who fear for the future of their party. The electoral coalition that was forged by Boris Johnson to get Brexit done has crumbled. Now, only half of those who backed the Tories last time say that they will do so at the next election, which is set to take place within the next 10 months.
You went Tory last time.
Yeah.
And how do you feel about that now? Was it a good choice?
To me, no.
I am traditionally a Conservative voter, but unfortunately they have made such a mess of everything.
No, I think Labour deserve a chance. I really do.
Labour's future looks much brighter. Its poll lead of around 20 percentage points has hardly budged in 12 months. To find out who its prospective voters are, The Economist has dug beneath the numbers, and the results show that Labour's electoral coalition could be even broader than the one squandered by the Tories.
So we created this model of individual voting behaviour using data from about 100,000 Brits from WeThink, which is a polling company.
Tom Sass is our Britain public policy editor.
And what it does is it calculates voting intention based on about eight characteristics. So those are things like age, sex, and education. And this model really shows that of all the biggest population groups, all of them have turned away from the Conservative government.
Okay, so let's dig into that data a little bit. Who are these groups shifting away from the Tories?
So we've looked at three in particular in our reporting. So the first group is a group of voters who are referred to in Britain as red wall voters. And if you remember back to the last election, this was a big chunk of voters that had voted Labour and switched over to the Conservatives. So a classic red wall voter would be a sort of white man in the Northwest between 55 and 64. The second group we looked at is a bit different, a bit more in traditional kind of Tory territory in the south of the country. And this is a middle-aged working mother with a mortgage in the suburbs in the southeast of the country. So this is called Stevenage Woman by some of the pollsters after a town in the south of England. Back in 2019, both of these groups were more likely to vote Conservative than Labour. They're now twice as likely to back Labour. And the third group, we looked north of the border to Scotland. Labour's been really struggling in Scotland for quite a few years now. At the last election, it secured just two seats. But the latest polling data puts them level with the Scottish National Party, so they could become the largest party in Scotland once more.
Now, Tom, we don't even know when the election's going to be held yet, and it could be a while. But if all those voters vote how they say they will, what will this mean?
it would be a pretty seismic result. It would be one of the largest swings ever in a British general election. And you can go back to 1945 or 1997, these moments where we've seen real tidal shifts, and it could be even bigger than either of those elections. So if the polls hold firm to where they are now, we'd see the Tories losing all 45 of the so-called Red Wall seats in the North and the Midlands that they won last time. But on top of that, you're going to see the Lib Dems and Labour making big inroads in the south of England. You've also got Reform UK, which is a sort of immigration sceptic party that's going to potentially take quite a lot of votes off the Tories as well. And then, as I mentioned, you'll see Labour coming back in Scotland. So that's going to be a pretty huge shift in just one parliament. We won't have seen as big a shift in a very long time in Britain. And that's partly caused by the Conservatives making a series of blunders and Labour sort of rebuilding its reputation. But there are also a couple of longer term factors at work beneath the surface.
So let's talk about those. What's the first factor?
So the first is increased volatility. And this is a trend that you see around the Western world, but we particularly see it here in Britain. So if you look back to the 1960s in Britain, only around an eighth of British voters changed their vote between elections. They were what is known as being a swing voter. By the 1980s, that had gone up to about a fifth. At the last election, political scientists here calculated that most of the electorate were now swing voters. And that's been driven by a few things. You've got falling partisanship, so people are less allied to specific parties. And you've also had the rise of smaller parties like the Liberal Democrats and some of the anti-immigration parties and the Greens. But this shift was also hugely accelerated by Brexit. So Brexit sort of severed these already fraying party loyalties. So those sort of red wall voters who went away from Labour for the first time to the Conservatives. And as a result of this sort of increased volatility, what it means is that voters are more likely to deliver big shocks in elections, and particularly when you have catalyzing events. So that could be Brexit, but it could also be the calamitous budget that we saw last year, where Liz Truss caused a sort of run on sterling with her mini budget.
And then what's the second factor?
So the second big factor is the restructuring of British politics around age and education. And again, this was happening before. It's been quite a long-term trend. You've had the fall in class allegiances. You've had the increase of higher education. But again, it was supercharged by Brexit. And what you've seen is the Conservatives at the last election scoop up all of the sort of older and less educated voters, and Labour retreat to the cities and more urban and university seats. Now, what's happened this time is the Conservative support has just collapsed among pretty much everyone of working age and the young. So at the last election, the crossover age where voters were more likely to vote Tory than Labour was 45. And at the next one, according to our data, it's going to be 68. So what you see is the Conservatives really becoming a party of pensioners. And actually, that single fact helps to explain the depth of Tory worries. They're sort of staring into the abyss at this point if they can't attract younger voters in the way that actually conservative parties in other parts of the Western world, like the US, are still able to do. There are several reasons younger voters might have been turned off the Tories, but chief among them seems to be housing. So you've seen housing affordability become a really big issue for younger people. Only around a third of Britons own their own home at the age of 30. And that's a problem that the Tories have really struggled to address in the last 14 years.
And it's not as if Britain's housing crisis is going to be solved before the election, though. So it's beginning to sound like Labour pretty much won, no?
You are going to see Keir Starmer and the Labour Party come under a lot more scrutiny as a campaign approaches. We've already seen Labour's position on the Israel-Gaza conflict, for example, cause quite a lot of anguish within his own party, among his MPs, and particularly among some of his younger voters. And actually, Labour has lost quite a lot of Muslim voters here too. But at the same time, this campaign is going to be dominated by a few factors that are going to be pretty difficult territory for the Tories. So the cost of living remains the dominant issue for most voters. And then the NHS is the second one. And that's somewhere where the government has failed to meet its own target of halving waiting lists. So it's going to be a tricky campaign for the Tories.
Tom, assuming Labour does win, how might this really broad electoral base affect what they then do in government?
Well, the thing which our analysis shows is that this is going to be the youngest coalition ever to elect a government in the UK, if things go as it's looking at the moment. So even compared to 1997, where you had a big Labour landslide, this voting coalition is going to be much, much younger. And what we're going to see as a result of that is a party that's more willing to prioritise the interests of younger people, so building houses, getting infrastructure built, potentially having a sort of more pragmatic relationship with the European Union. But also, if we see Labour return to dominance in Wales and become competitive again in Scotland, you'll see strains on the Union become a bit easier as well. None of that means it's going to be an easy coalition for Labour to hold together. So you're going to see, you know, very cramped in terms of public spending and what it can do quickly. And I think the other big tension you're going to see, if it wins back those red wall voters we've been talking about, is this tension between sort of social conservatives on the one hand and young progressives on the other. And that's going to be a running issue under a Labour government.
Tom, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
Aber ich glaube, ein irgendwie gearteter Versuch einer Zwischenlösung, stell dir mal vor, das kommt an die Presse. Wir haben unseren...
Imagine it being released to the press, says a German Air Force officer. Well, it was. This is the sound of Germany's embarrassment.
Man kann es natürlich so drehen, dass man sagt, also wenn der politische Wille jetzt...
It's a conversation between four top German Air Force officers that took place on February 19th and was leaked by Russia on March the 1st.
Max Rodenbeck is our Berlin bureau chief.
They discuss British troops on the ground in Ukraine and militarily critical and politically hypersensitive matters around the supply of German-made Taurus cruise missiles to Ukraine.
Yeah.
The leak exposed a few secrets, luckily minor ones. The generals had chatted about technicalities of using Taurus missiles to destroy the Kerch Bridge, which links Russia to the occupied Crimean Peninsula. The leak came amid mounting pressure on Olaf Scholz, the German Chancellor, to supply the cruise missiles, which have a particularly long range, to Ukraine. It also infuriated NATO allies, who prefer to keep quiet about the involvement of small numbers of their own special forces in Ukraine. And it followed another embarrassing German military incident.
A German naval frigate reportedly almost shot down a U.S. Reaper drone by accident.
They only missed because two interceptor missiles crashed.
Max, how on earth did this happen?
Well, the cause of the phone leak wasn't a systematic problem with German communications, but it was a single human error. There was an officer who joined the call from Singapore. He was at a hotel attending an air show in Singapore. And, you know, that's just the sort of place that Russia would bug. But the naval mishap in the Red Sea at the same time wasn't entirely the Germans' fault. It was partly the Americans' fault. It turns out that the Americans had failed to alert the German ship that the approaching killer drone was actually a friendly American drone and not an attack by a drone flown by Houthi rebels in Yemen, which is what the Germans were expecting. And in fact, the German frigate did block a couple of incoming Houthi drones just one day afterwards.
But these kinds of small errors can have pretty large impacts. How badly have these German errors affected military security and trust?
Well, the only immediate damage is really to Germany's reputation. The conversation itself revealed not much, really, that Russia doesn't already know about the Taurus missile program or German defense in general. At the same time, the generals were speaking very frankly about how they ought to wait for political decisions. And that should, in fact, be reassuring to Germans. It shows that their soldiers respect democracy and are in no rush for war.
Wenn wir uns denn mal politisch entscheiden würden, die Ukraine zu supporten damit, wie könnte denn die ganze Nummer am Ende...
Even so, the German defense minister was quite right to be what he described as very, very angry.
Vorgang mitnichten herunter. Ich nehme ihn sehr, sehr ernst, weil hier ganz offenkundig nicht die Sorgfalt an den Tag gelegt worden ist, die notwendig.
This interception was an intelligence coup for Russia, which has helped it to sow mistrust between Ukraine's allies, obviously a good thing for Mr. Putin. And, you know, it's important to note that the Kremlin trumpeted this call as proof, as it put it, that Germany plans to attack Russian civilian infrastructure, which is not entirely true from the conversation that we hear, but that's how the Russians have presented to their people. And this not only fits nicely into a Russian propaganda narrative that paints its war on Ukraine as a sort of righteous struggle against Western perfidy, but it conveniently also bolsters an image of Vladimir Putin that he likes to project, which is being a sort of patriotic protector and also of being a brilliant spymaster. And this comes just days before he is scheduled to be re-elected president of Russia.
So overall, this is a very bad look for Germany. Where did this leave the Chancellor's decision on Taurus?
Mr. Scholz had already, just before the release of this tape, said that he was not providing the Taurus missiles to the Ukraine. But because of the risk, he said, that Ukraine might just fire missiles at Moscow, and because he also said that German soldiers would have to program the targets in the cruise missiles, and this would make Germany what he called a party to the war. Those were Mr. Scholz's concerns. But what was interesting from the tape is that his own generals mentioned no such particular concerns. And instead, they were actually just discussing in a general way workarounds to such problems, including, for example, letting German allies do the targeting so that German soldiers wouldn't have to do that in Ukraine. One particularly embarrassing moment for Mr. Scholz in the taped conversation is when one of the generals sort of shrugs and says, no one really knows why the Chancellor is blocking. He's referring to the Taurus missiles.
Warum blockt der Kanzler hier? Kommen natürlich abenteuerlichste Gerüchte.
So, yeah, that doesn't look good for Mr. Scholz. And in fact, the longer-term fallout from all these military mess-ups may be more domestic than international. What they really do is show that even after 2 years of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and after Mr. Scholz declared a Zeitenwende, which means a sort of immense turning point in time for Germany's military posture, its security culture and military capacity are both still quite deficient.
Max, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Ori.
Kishiki Norio has just pulled up outside her home in Akashi, a city in western Japan.
Marika Ida writes about Japan for The Economist.
She drives the white truck with a big heart logo and a slogan saying, "Diaper delivery, we also deliver kindness." She steps out of the truck carrying two bags of nappies and hands them to a young mother who has appeared at the door with a baby on her hip. Ms. Kishiki is on the front line of a decade-long push by Akashi to encourage residents to have children. Ms. Kishiki explains that, as well as delivering diapers, she makes an effort to talk to the woman raising children to help alleviate their concerns. The city has also implemented other policies, such as providing free medical care and school lunches for children in the area. These efforts seem to be paying off. Akashi's population has been steadily increasing for the past 10 years. That sets an example for the rest of Japan.
So, Marika, how does Akashi compare to the rest of Japan?
Akashi is doing exceptionally well. Japan's birth rate has been steadily declining since the mid-1970s. In 2022, the number of total births in the country dipped below 800,000 for the first time since records began in the late 1890s. Japan's Prime Minister Kishida Fumio even said that the country is now on the brink of social dysfunction because of its demographic problems. In Akashi, the birth rate is 1.65 compared to the national figure, which is 1.3. There's a lot of problems that have to be addressed at the national level. For instance, inflexible family laws and also high education costs. But places like Akashi show how local communities can also make a difference.
So is it safe to say that Akashi is a standalone example?
There's also a town called Nagareyama in Shiba, a commuter town outside of Tokyo, which is also seeing a booming population. The population there has grown by almost 25% in the past decade. That largely has to do with accessibility. The place has an express train that connects it to Tokyo, but good childcare policies have also helped attract young families. That was Izaki Yoshiharu, Nagareyama's mayor. He explained that the town has made a lot of efforts to make it easier for young families to raise children while working. In Japan, the lack of childcare facilities has been a big problem. And the central government has made significant improvements in recent years. So there used to be a lot of children on waiting lists to enter nurseries, but they managed to reduce the number of children on the waiting list by 90%. Nagareyama has been at the forefront of these efforts. In the past 15 years, the town increased the number of nurseries from 17 to more than 100. The examples I mentioned so far sound quite simple. I mentioned diaper delivery and also building childcare facilities. And you might wonder, are families going to start having children just because of those efforts? But I think examples like Akashi and Nagareyama point to a more fundamental shift that's required in Japan more broadly.
What do you mean by a more fundamental shift?
There's a strong sense of urgency in Japan when it comes to demographic problems. I mentioned the Prime Minister said the country is on the brink of social dysfunction. There was a tweet by Elon Musk that said Japan will cease to exist if the birth rate continues to decline, and people were responding to that. So there's a lot of fear around population decline, but I think what tends to get overlooked is that we still don't have a culture that's generous to children. One example is how efforts to build childcare facilities often get blocked by locals who complain about the potential noise it might create. Also, there's a popular restaurant chain called Soupstock, and I remember last year when it started offering free food for babies at its stores, there was a huge online backlash from people saying that they don't want to sit next to crying babies. I spoke to mothers in Nagareyama, and they were saying that the policies themselves may not necessarily be that substantial, but what they really appreciate about the town is that there's an abundance of young families, and there's this culture that's very generous to them. Akashi's pro-child efforts, like the diaper delivery, are also not necessarily about the diapers or the goods themselves, but it's also about driving that culture change. The diapers are being passed to the hands of one young mother, Miss Higuchi. She was saying that raising children can be an overwhelming experience, so it's nice when someone checks in on her. It makes her feel as if she's on the right track. I think the rest of the country has a lot to learn from places like Akashi and Nagareyama, and I think the most important lesson is to drive culture change, to make Japan much kinder to children.
Marika, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. Economist Podcast Plus, our subscription to some of our best content, is now available for half price. For less than $2.50 a month, you can get an annual or a two-year plan to our weekly feature shows like Money Talks and our limited series too. But guys, the offer won't last forever. Let's be honest, how much longer can you bear me banging on about this? So go on, click the link in the show notes to grab the bargain, and we'll see you back here tomorrow.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.